people who, like myself, find it quite difficult to define ourselves in disciplinary terms. So we're perhaps a little bit like Justin, you know, we're able to move about a bit, we find. I appreciated all of your comments there. I wanted to ask you about a quite practical matter and wonder how you handled this. Publishing. How have you dealt with those kinds of issues where journals are often highly disciplinary, and of course publishing is important in terms of which directions different people are going in terms of the REF or RAE as it was. So I'm just intrigued about how you've dealt with some of those issues.
Great, thank you very much. Just there, Simon, thank you.
Simon Roberts from the Centre for Sustainable Energy. As most of the panel know, I sat on the advisory board for the Resolve programme, so I've seen this kind of interdisciplinarity and multidisciplinarity kind of through its rise and fall and rise again, I think might be the best way to describe it in terms of the process. But so my kind of question's around that, and it's... But I also want to... Well, first of all, who do you think did best at it out of the various disciplines? Because I think it's important, because I have my own views, which I might share afterwards. The second one is, what did it actually do for your own discipline? Because one of the things I felt quite strongly was that people weren't necessarily challenging the techniques and methods within their own disciplines as a result of trying to study things that might be slightly outside their usual purview. So, for example, an ethnographic study that wasn't prepared to look at energy bills in the home, because asking the ethnographic study client, whatever one calls them, might alert them to the fact you were trying to find out something very specific. Whereas actually what we wanted to know was how much energy were they using, because that might have an effect on whether what they were saying was true or not. So there were kind of issues around that. So that's the second one. What has it done for your own thinking about your own discipline? And then the third one is, how has it actually changed the work you're interested in doing in the future?
Okay. And here, ready here, thank you.
Thank you. My name is Rachel Howell. I'm at the University of Edinburgh. I was very struck by what you said, Birgitta, about how you felt that there might be a place for multidisciplinary work rather than interdisciplinary work, because it's perhaps too much to ask of especially PhD students and early career researchers to be interdisciplinary because they're being trained in a specific discipline. Now, I'm a PhD student. I'm doing a very interdisciplinary PhD. I call myself an environmental social scientist. I don't get more specific than that. My original training was, I actually did a first degree in maths, and I've got into doing this interdisciplinary PhD through a multidisciplinary master's. I am supervised by several different people, all of whom are natural scientists who have got interested in the social questions around climate change. If that sounds like a bit of a nightmare, it is a little bit of a nightmare, but it's also great fun and a great opportunity and challenge. The training that was offered to me that I should have taken as a person who's in a particular department, geosciences department, I could see right from the outset was going to be no use at all. So I went off and got completely different training, methods training, in a different school, which is in fact I think in a different college in the university. So there's lots of problems there, but I also feel like it's got lots of positives. So for example, I'm trying to bring together psychological and sociological literatures and insights and methods, and because I'm neither a sociologist nor a psychologist, it means I don't have to work so hard to take off one hat to understand other hats. I'm not struggling so much with being really deeply embedded in one kind of paradigm. So I see that as one positive. But there are also these difficulties, for example, how to avoid becoming a jack of all trades and a master at none. It is impossible to know as much about all those disciplines as a person who's just in one discipline. I don't think that necessarily has to be a reason not to do it, because actually I know more about cross stuff. I know more about patterns and linkages and so on, so that might be my speciality. But it does mean it's difficult the way people look at you. I'm, you know, like a psychologist might look down on me because I don't know enough about psychology, and a sociologist might look down on me because I don't know enough about sociology. I'm already thinking about who shall I get as an external examiner, and I'm already saying to myself, no way a sociologist, because they really won't like the quantitative psychological bits of my thesis and so on. So I just, for all of you, not just for Geeta, I just wanted to ask, do you think, as I do, that it is actually worth and sort of training a new generation of truly interdisciplinary researchers, not instead of single disciplines, but as well as, so might there be a place for people who are environmental social scientists and not something more specific? And do you have any insights about how to overcome those kind of challenges of, you know, being jack of all trade and the journal issue, how to get published and so on, that kind of stuff? Thanks.
Great, thank you very much. So, specialisation and links with the ref. Who's best at doing interdisciplinary work? And has Rachel got a new paradigm here? And I completely go along with that. I feel like an interdisciplinary social scientist with no real home, just like you. So who'd like to pick up on any of those? Prashant, please.
As a comment about the interdisciplinary and who's best to do stuff. I think, you know, which discipline kind of leads on a research project depends very much on the project. So some in DEFRA's sort of terms of reference at the moment, ecosystem services is a very big deal. And I think there's a natural kind of succession there of natural science, maybe biologists, maybe geographers, essentially quantifying the ecosystem services, and then social scientists sort of taking over. So I don't think it's obvious that, you know, who should lead, who should follow. If you're trying to influence government, you know, you just got to be aware that government listens in economics. So at somewhere along the way, you do need to actually sort of pick that up. And I mean, I would very much recommend that as a second degree, you do a social science like economics, but you know, base it on a sort of a solid a natural science first. And that's my own background, and I know Tim's got a similar kind of background. There's an awful lot of dogma in economics, which, you know, frankly, you should not do until you've grown up enough to ignore it first.
Thank you.
I think absolutely it's definitely a really good idea to train more people to be interdisciplinary, even if it's because one of the things in a multidisciplinary project, even if you have lots of people working in their own discipline, you need the people who can collate all this stuff together. You need the really interdisciplinary people. So yes, I think it's really important that we, and I think there is more and more of those people emerging, and like you said, there is some training out there. It might not be a lot of it, but there is some training out there. And in the longer term, I think that also addresses the issue of publication problems, because if there are more people out there doing interdisciplinary research, there will be more journals which will be more respected. And of course, we are really struggling with the ref at the moment. And one of the things, for instance, we've done in our in psychology is that we had to generate this list with top publications which we think the people in our department should be publishing in. And David Russell was very good at trying to make sure that there are some journals in there that are actually interdisciplinary journals, like Global Environmental Change, I think it's called. So I think there is a way, and I know that people in psychology, the hardcore cognitive neuroscientists in our department, will not respect a publication in Global Environmental Change. They'll probably won't see that as proper science. But there are other people where it is respected. So I think it's a slow process, but it is definitely moving. It's moving in a direction. I just hope it keeps on going in that direction, because one of my fears is, particularly now with the ref going on, is that there was, in my sort of opinion, sort of experience, there was a real more and more respect for working on sort of practical issues within our own department. But now at the ref, this pressure is so on, even though there's a pressure on doing something that's applied and it has impact, the pressure on publishing in something that has in neuroscience, psychology or whatever is even greater. So that's one of the things I think. I hope we can keep this momentum going. And I think, in answer to your who's best at it, and that's actually I come best back to you as well, is I think maybe I was wrong in saying, now think of it, that maybe the young researchers are the ones that should be protected from this. Perhaps it's the young researchers who are actually better at it because they come from it from a different angle. Maybe it's the people like us who sit in a psychology department, have been sitting there for however long, and who are sort of ingrained in that, who are really struggling with this. So maybe it's actually the young researchers who are better at it than I think. From my perspective, I'm not very good at it. I keep trying. But I've seen a lot of people around me in Brazil who are very good at it. So I think it does require a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of energy from the researchers to do this, to retrain yourself, to keep looking outside and to keep sort of struggling with the ref.
Can I just add to that? Yeah, in the sense of, you know, you asked the question, you know, is it a good thing? Yes, I would say undoubtedly it is. And the question then springs to mind, if we're still, you know, you go to any university, it's still got all its silos of discipline. So where do you train these people? There aren't that many opportunities to train in that sense. And that's why I think Resolve has done really well, because it's put a number of PhD students through in the sort of 5 years that it's been running. And, you know, if you ask those PhD students what their experience of it is, I don't know what they'll say. I can't speak for them. But from my own perspective, it's been really refreshing. Just, you know, they were across from me. They're in a room across from my room. And it was really nice that I could just go and chat to them. And hopefully it was nice that they could come and chat to me and a number of other researchers. So that they just on a daily basis got perspectives from geographers, sociologists, economists, psychologists. And so they became interdisciplinary in that sense on a daily basis. And I think that's incredibly important. So I think these projects do have a role to play in producing interdisciplinary researchers, because you have that environment where it can actually happen. So, yeah.
Who did it best? The geographers, which is just an eye, because we both worked across sociology and psychology, obviously. But I also say the B1 people who kind of picked bits up. It's difficult. Then going back and publishing the piece of work that we just completed, we're pretty much looking to publish in sociological journals, and it does then become quite purely sociological, really, and I think it's quite hard, certainly some of the perspectives that we've taken, to try and open that out, to take other perspectives in, and I think sociology in particular, because it, you know, particularly taking a sort of structuration framework, a social practices framework, it's very difficult to then take a lot of the psychological stuff in and get it published. but maybe that again is about, and maybe that gets harder when you've got the ref, but yeah, the point about needing different interdisciplinary journals in the ref, that's true. Your point about taking in different data to pick up the carbon data, we didn't talk about doing that with my project. I mean, it didn't fall out because I dismissed it, but it fell out because we went sort of, well, Chris actually went his different way with his project. But yeah, that is very difficult. I mean, working from a perspective that I come from, I go in and I talk to people about their leisure practices, and I try and decenter environment as much as possible. That is my perspective. I want to go in, I want to know what people do. I don't want them knowing what my agenda is. And so those sorts of things, it does make it difficult, and I do have a problem with, but that's not just being challenged from a sort of disciplinary perspective when you want to pick up these sort of carbon things, but also challenged a lot more from the ethics agenda, whereby, you know, the ethics team and everything now gets run through ethics committees before it goes out. It says, these people need to know what it is you're researching. You know, you shouldn't be coming out and asking them, you know, you can't go and run a leisure study and at the end of it say, let's talk about your carbon. They need to know from the first place, but it makes it quite difficult, because does it change the things that people say to you? I'm sure it does. I'm sure it does. I'm sure people, when you're going and, you know, people randomly say to me, I like to recycle. Well, they're not randomly saying it to me. You know, I haven't asked the question. They're saying it to me when I'm not talking about that at all, because, you know, they know that somewhere in there, there's going to be that element of it. So I think it makes it quite difficult, but I think the ethics stuff that's coming through almost negates that anyway, if we're going to follow that. And so everybody needs to know exactly what we're researching. I don't know how you decenter those findings anyway, which I don't know is a different subject. Maybe we'll come back to it. I wanted to say something about how you actually about self-presentation and methodologies anyway.
Okay, well, hold on to that one. We'll come back to that. Bronwyn,
it's fine. Oh, if I just very quickly say, I think as a sort of a summary to the three questions, the things that I would take home and take away from this experience is the value of creating creative public space to think differently and reclaiming the role of the academic as a conscience and critic in society, and also the value that small really is beautiful. The small research teams work well, but their power comes from their abilities to link both with the community, your own communities, and also your international communities. And that's really where the longevity effect comes. And also, when you're in a little research team, you don't really know what the value is until you hear back from the community what they need and what they think you're saying and what they think the problems are. So the links with the 20 other countries through the UN Environment Programme research programmes, and the link for transition towns and the link for communities here in the UK has been very valuable, and it's also meant a way of thinking about the research differently. And I also did find it incredibly moving that in the middle of the mud, with no university, with lots of deaths and family tragedy, I've got undergraduate students coming to me with the prosperity book, with the plenitude, with the transition town book, with, you know, it is lovely to have something, as we say, Te Ranga Waewae, as something to offer, a place to stand, and I appreciate it, and I also appreciate this opportunity to network with you.
Thank you very much. Just before we take another round, Simon, you said that you changed your mind. I just want to hear quickly what you thought about interdisciplinarity.
I was impressed by the economists, to the extent that they challenged the kind of orthodox thinking and probably went furthest in terms of the way they would normally approach an issue as opposed to the way they ended up approaching an issue. And I think you heard some of that stuff earlier today from Mona, in terms of just taking a different slant on it from an economist's perspective, but trying to bring some of these other issues into it. I actually think the thing I would take away, and maybe help Rachel as well, is that actually what you're getting out of interdisciplinarity is subject experts. Not discipline experts, but subject experts. And it's really important that universities have people who understand an issue rather than just a discipline. And I think, obviously, within disciplines, you get people who understand issues within disciplines, but they still have a very narrow focus on that. But actually, I think that... So I think, you know, don't be afraid to understand community engagement with climate change issues and descent paths or whatever. That's a really important thing to understand, and to bring lots of different perspectives on that through your own work, rather than necessarily think you've got to understand everything about psychology in order to be able to talk sensibly about the psychology of that issue. So I think, to me, that's kind of one of the things, and I think that's where some of the younger people in the project, as you're saying, actually brought that to it. Their kind of passion for the issues was kind of greater than their concern about learning and becoming expert in a particular discipline. And I think we may be nice to think, though I don't think with the Research Council's approach, it'd be nice to think that that's where academics were going in terms of thinking across issues, because that's actually what we need to sort out in the world, rather than thinking about schools of thought. Because generally speaking, you need three or four different economists to understand the economy properly. You need their different perspectives. So we ought to be thinking kind of that way as much as that way. So.
Yeah. Thank you very much. That's great. Let's take three more. Please, here. Juliet. And then.
Thank you. Well, this has been a really interesting conversation. I wanted to raise two things. One is the difference between disciplines and paradigms, because you have a discipline like economics, which is at this point now almost totally dominated by one paradigm, a little bit less here, a little bit less today than it was 3 years ago. And then you have others like sociology, of course, which doesn't even have in some, it almost doesn't have a paradigm, it's so diverse. And I think a lot of the really productive work that's been done in recent years is about paradigm challenges and not just across disciplines. Now, sometimes it is. I mean, you mentioned behavioral economics. Of course, that was psychologists who did that, not economists. It was a challenge to the economic model that gave us behavioral economics. You know, eventually economists got into it. But so that's the first point. I think we shouldn't be, you know, think too much about those disciplinary boundaries, particularly now if you think about what's happening in the sciences, which is all those boundaries coming down, and they're moving to much more integrated thinking. And I think it is, I hope it's going to happen in the social sciences too. But one of the issues I think we have in this field that we're talking about is the word behavior and the whole concept of behavior. Now, this is 1950s, 1960s terminology. In my country, we have schools of social and behavioral sciences. That drives me completely mad, as if sociology and anthropology were not about what people do, but individualist approaches own the concept of behavior, economics and psychology. And behavioral economics is as individualist as neoclassical economics. It's better, but it doesn't move on that. And I think that my own view is that the quote-unquote behavioral model, which is that individualist model, is really on the way out. And that moving forward, it's the social, the models that understand people in their social context. Of course, we heard a lot about this today already from the group. But this is where I think the language matters. And the more we're trapped in a language of behavior change, the more we are having to talk about individuals, and we're going to get the wrong paradigm for understanding what's happening. It's not a question, but maybe people could comment on it.
Sure, thank you. And lady just behind you.
Yeah, thank you. I must be one of the very few artists around here, and I've also worked at interdisciplinary research. And what I really miss in this kind of research is the artist's point of view. Bronwyn was mentioning the imagination and the importance of the imagination, and as artists, that's exactly what we work with. And we also work with our own form of research, which is across the boundaries. And I think it's a question as well as a statement. It's a very important part that seemed to have been forgotten somehow, as a little single cry from a corner here. I just wanted to also mention what you were saying about publishing before, and communicating the research is, you know, maybe we have become stagnant in the way that we're communicating our research, you know, within the journal form, and by incorporating artists in the research teams, we can also think of other ways of communicating that can go to the heart of the communities. And I just like to go back to the imagination. Brian Eno, a fantastic multidisciplinary artist, he's written a fantastic passage that I always come back to. Humans are capable of a unique trick, creating realities by first imagining them, by extracting them in their minds. As soon as we sense the possibility of a more desirable world, we begin behaving differently, as though that world is starting to come into existence. So.
Great, thank you very much. One more final question. And here again at the front, thank you. Thanks.
Thanks so much. That was really quite interesting. In my experience in doing interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary research, a lot of the challenges that you guys are talking about are often really solved or put aside or in some way overcome by what is the main question, what is the main output, who is the main audience, what is the problem you're trying to solve? And then you can kind of figure out your way. What's the goal? Like, we know what the means are. We all know we want to be interdisciplinary something or other. We want to shift paradigms. But, like, what's the goal that we're trying, in this particular situation, trying to solve? And given what the Baroness was talking about earlier and sort of other kind of more macro discussions, I'm just sort of wondering, like, you can kind of give some reflections on how you've been able, how you either have been or how you want to be able to use what you've learned in order to really, you know, she's been sort of asking for in the way that, that people often do without knowing what they're asking for, perhaps. Real solutions to, whether it be job problems or you know, creating some sustainable lifestyles that can affect for policymakers. And so, like, how can you communicate and how can you use what you have developed to really get into those policy circles? And is that a solution? Is that a way out of some of these challenges?
Great, thank you. So we've got Juliet's point on disciplines versus paradigms, particularly in relation to the need for a richer understanding of context, getting away from what she called a 50s and 60s view of behavior, role of arts and imagination, and then the question about what we've learned, how does it get applied in real world solutions and communications? Who'd like to kick off on that? Justin, please.
Just very quickly on Juliet's point, really. I think it's very much the value of some of the disciplines is their ability to critique others. Now, that, you know, it sometimes comes across and people say, well, why are you, you know, sort of infighting? Why is that going on? But I think it's extremely important. And one of the things that's been useful to me, say, is work in sort of a branch of sociology, economic sociology. So the work of Michel Calon, people like Danny Miller, an anthropologist, and James Carrier, who have all been looking at the market as a constructed thing, as opposed to this, you know, pre-existing sort of entity. So yeah, I won't say too much, but I just think that is an incredibly important part of the discipline, is to critique these particular paradigms. So in that sense, it is, you know, the work that they've been doing is very much a critique of the neoclassical, the rational man. Yes, they do exist, but not naturally, that they're constructed. So, yeah, and I think these are important things.
Who's next? Pikita, Tracy?
Yeah, I can go next. I guess also in relation to that point and that question. I was trained as a cognitive psychologist, so very much the individualistic model. And I was it was interesting when we started the Resolve project, I remember having a discussion with the economists in the project, where we actually sort of thought, well, maybe we have more in common than any of the others because we were working with this individualistic model. And I was really quite interested when you said this individualistic model is on the way out, because and I think that relates to something you said earlier as well, and how does the project made you change your thinking? And I think from working in these multidisciplinary teams, yes, it changed my way of thinking from what I was trained in towards thinking beyond this individualistic model. However, then we got the REF, and it has had a massive impact, I think, on our department, but I think also in psychology departments in general. And also, I think in other countries, even where they don't have the REF, I see a very clear movement in psychology away from this sort of multidisciplinary thinking outside the box, more and more towards sticking somebody in a brain scanner and just away from all the others. And I don't know if it's like a defensive mode of psychology. I don't know what it is, but that's a clear move. And I thought really interesting also what Bronwyn said earlier about the sort of, I can't remember exactly what you said, but the sort of almost arrogance that this people who work with this paradigm think they have the answer and the solution. And maybe that's the sort of defensive, I don't know what it is, but that's something that is very clearly happening. So from my perspective, that is something that, and also from, I think, from perspective from my colleagues, that's something that we're really struggling with, to, on the one hand, wanting to expand our horizons and work in multidisciplinary teams and working beyond our disciplines and involving different perspectives and beyond sticking somebody in front of a computer screen or a brain scanner, to actually talking to them, observing them in real life settings, but not being able to publish that in the journals that we are persuaded to publish in. So I think
that was one
point on that, which is part of what I meant is that I think in psychology, you're going, you know, 10, 15 years from now, there's going to be even more studying the ways, whether you're doing it through brain scans or not, but the socialness of humans, because that's where the evolutionary psychology is going.
Yes.
So I think it's not method so much as it's the theory.
Yes. Yes, no, I agree. And I think that, there is that in that shift, but there is at the moment, maybe it's a temporary shift to sort of move to, from one direction to the other. Comment on the other questions. I think the idea of having a clear goal is really, really important. And that's one of the things, knowing where you're going to. What I mentioned before was that I went to this workshop a while ago where we had to think about how to work and how is it going to work, how do you work in multidisciplinary groups where people said you have to put people in a room and don't let them out until they have defined this common goal and a strategy towards getting there. And somebody then also said, well, decisions are going to be made anyway. Policymakers are going to make decisions. They're going to be made anyway. Do we want them to make them with us having some input in it? Or do we not? And so actually thinking about how our research is going to have a practical outcome, I think is really, really useful. And I think that requires more, maybe also smaller scale projects where you work towards a very specific common goal in a way to come to that practical outcome. Which I don't think we do enough of, I think. And the other thing about artists, I really like that. And I think actually that's one of the things. I don't know of any projects that have specifically involved artists. I'm sure there have been, but we have had a discussion about this specifically because of this idea of communicating our research outputs and how do we actually engage people. And I've been having discussions with people on bio communities about sort of soil, micro creatures in the soil, and to get people involved in understanding what goes on in the soil. And we actually had a discussion there about involving artists to sort of visually show what is going on, and because that's not something that we can think of. So I think that's definitely something that we need to think of more in the future, because I think it would be really valuable. Yeah.
I hate to mention that time is running out, but time is running out, so I'll ask for very quick responses along the line from Tracy and then Prashant and Bronwyn.
Okay, the disciplines and paradigms one, yes, I think that comes through, and my point about, as I started, which is, you know, when I talk to different economists, you get these very, very different views. That seems to be incredibly strong within the economic strand, particularly maybe within Resolve, where we've got very different economic thinkers. But I think it also comes through, not necessarily so much through a paradigm, but maybe what you're studying within the sociology stuff, in particular looking at leisure, that relationship. Are you looking at practices? Are you looking at time use? Are you looking at energy use? I think that brings out some very different things in terms of what does it mean. Are you looking at the meaning for people? Are you looking at, you know, the level of carbon use? Are you looking at how to use time in a sustainable way? And so I think it is in there, and I think those can be brought together much more easily when with those different paradigms. But I think the time use ones are quite interesting because that's the one that's not really gone to the policy circle so much still. And so I think that's maybe something that we need to start talking more, because actually sociology has got massive amounts of time use studies, and it's one of its sort of central features. But yes, we've not been taking that to policy. So that might be one of those areas where we need to start talking in different paradigms rather than talking from a discipline when we talk to those.
I'll just respond to Juliet's comment. I think in economics there's a huge amount of heterogeneity in different viewpoints. I mean, even in a group like the Monetary Policy Committee, the MPC, you can have radically different points of view where some people believe that the inflationary pressures are more important than others, deflationary pressures. I used to be amongst a sort of group of heterodox economists who were arrogantly feel that they've got a brand new discipline altogether. It's not just a paradigm shift, it's a brand new discipline. And you know, we think that pretty much all the tenets of main economics is under dispute. So when I made the slightly flippant comment that you should do economics as a subsequent degree but do some proper science first, I slightly meant it, because in a way economics starts with a whole bunch of baggage, which is really the starting point is that markets are fundamentally functioning, and the market is a relationship between buyers and sellers. Well, I suppose a heterodox economist starts from the point that really on every level that's not right. I mean, the demand function, the essence of behavioural economics is really that the demand function is ill-formed. So preferences aren't sort of created at birth, but they're influenced by things like advertising. And even when people sort of have an idea of what they want, they're very imperfect consumers. They're risk-averse and all the other things we know about that behavioural economics brings. Ecological economics is a massive critique, saying that really some of the ideas of fungibility between capital assets aren't true. You can't just trade in soil loss with energy with a bit of built capital. They're fundamentally different things, and we need to conserve all of those. Similarly, the ideas of thermodynamics, that energy flows one way, means that there's limits to how much you can recycle things. So these are very substantial critiques. And that nowadays, you know, people like Stiglitz and Haijun Chang are coming in with institutional critiques, thinking that, you know, we're not just talking about individual agents, but a firm like a city bank or something has different kind of problems within it. So individual traders are incentivized to take risks with somebody else's money. They have the upside risk but not the downside risk if the firm goes bust. So these kind of institutional things, you know, the incentives on me to try to get promoted within my organization. But these are very, very fundamental challenges to economics. So I think it isn't just a slight paradigm shift. I think this is a brand new discipline of bringing in these ideas of ecology into thermodynamics, into psychology of within firm behavior, bringing that into economics. Only economics is arrogant enough to think that it can subsume all of these. It's another discipline.
Great, thank you. Finally, Bronwyn.
Very quickly, I really agree with what you're saying, Juliet. I didn't express it well enough, but thanks for capturing it. And it's when I said plan A, it's sort of the paradigm shift of how do we get to plan B. I think what the rediscovery of social agency is what gives me hope. And I took a mean sideswipe about my concern about social practices being depoliticising. But I think it's because context matters. And right now, the big societies, one of its first pre-terms I remember hearing was they were toying with the idea of the civil economy, which doesn't sell, neither did big society, but it shows more what it's about. It's about the removal of the democratic moment. It's the amalgamation of economics and the community without the democracy. And in that context, social agency could be depoliticized unless we really reclaim the opportunities for public space. So that, and what gives me hope is when citizens imagine new possibilities. And thank you, Eva, for saying about the role of arts, because that's been my most personal revelation from the earthquakes, is that faced with absolute disaster, people want inspiration and hope for something new. And it's been an honour to work with you. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Well, thank you for all those questions. It's been a really rich discussion. Please thank our panel. Thank you all very much. We're now going to break for tea. We're going to be back in here at 4:20 for our third keynote speech from Rob Hopkins. Thanks very much.